thank you for two very wonderful, wonderful selections this morning. Thank you so much. The 10-year anniversary observances and commemorations of 9/11 have come and gone, including the one we held around our peace pole here last Sunday. So perhaps another sermon on the subject today may well seem like an exercise in belaboring. Can't we just get on with things? Now, the short answer is yes, we can and we will. And I'll be devoting part of this sermon to anticipating the year ahead of us as a congregation, as I have almost done with the Sunday in September that follows our in-gathering and water service. I say almost always, for the last time I departed from this well-established pattern was 10 years ago this Sunday. September the 11th of 2001 fell on a Tuesday. It was the following Sunday, September the 16th, or Saturday the 15th, for the rabbis of our land. That really did present a daunting challenge for religious leaders, for members of the clergy all across the country and all across the religious spectrum. We knew we could not go with whatever sermon we'd been planning for our congregations before that Tuesday. And indeed, the following Sunday or Saturday, houses of worship all across the country were very full, were packed, including this one. And the last time I could remember, other than this, something like that happening, was the Sunday after the assassination of President Kennedy, as I show my age. November the 22nd, 1963, fell on the Friday before the Sunday that preceded Thanksgiving that year. And on that Sunday, November the 24th of 1963, great numbers of Americans brought their feelings of shock and grief and anger and bewilderment to their places of worship. They needed a place to be in a nation that had suffered a huge body blow. Other United States presidents had been murdered, but not in the lifetimes or memories of those who were living then. And I was only 18 years old at that time. I remember being in a Baptist church in Huntington, West Virginia, where I was going to college on that Sunday, but I remember nothing about the service. The more important thing I did take note of, however, was how people turned to their religious communities in times of national tragedy and grief. All right, we cut to September 16th, 2001, and by now I'm far away from being a college freshman with ministerial aspirations. Now I had a congregation of my own and one in a faith tradition that I'd barely even heard of when I was 18. The sermon I offered that Sunday, 5 days after the attacks themselves, is still on our website. I titled it For Us the Living. I went back and reread it. I didn't find a whole lot there I felt I needed to recall today, but there were a few lines I'm going to offer from the same pulpit that I spoke then. We know that grief, pain, and bewilderment, especially in the face of horrific loss, in time give way to anger. It would be almost inhuman not to feel anger after such a devastating attack. But where do we go with it? This is the challenge before us. As we weep for our dead, as we begin to clear away the rubble, as we confront our newly felt sense of vulnerability, where do we go with our anger? And then this. We're still feeling knocked down. Perhaps that's why so many of you have come here this morning. We're still seeking comfort. I trust you will find the right measure of that comfort here today. But now, as anger begins to supplant grief and shock, we would do well to consider how we pick ourselves up. This is the challenge before us, and it is clearly the challenge before those who lead this nation. And that's as much as I'm going to lift from that old sermon. So, cut to last Sunday. Something struck me about the 10-year observances, the one we did here, the one down at the Labyrinth that our Interfaith Council supported, and some of the ones that I caught on television, both in the days leading up to and on that Sunday. And the ones that I observed or took part in, I couldn't help but note how they had a pretty low key and a rather somber tone to them. I saw very little, if any, bravado, not much of any kind of hyper excessive expressions of nationalism. There may have been some of that nature, but I didn't see them. Perhaps the passing of 10 years has given us time to reflect on how we did pick ourselves up, for good and for ill, and where some of the anger and fear that understandably flowed from the events of a decade ago took us, it is sobering to think about that. We as a nation did come together in some very admirable ways. We reached out, we continue to reach out to those whose lives were so grievously harmed by all that happened on that horrible day. We quite rightly honored the bravery of those who risked and in some cases lost their lives in the rescue efforts. We did a number of things right in picking ourselves up. But we've also paid a sad price, I think, for some of the other ways in which we picked ourselves up. And I devoted a good number of sermons over the past decade to some of the shadow outcomes of what came to be called the War on Terror, and to revisit them now would be unduly exhaustive. But the president of our UU Association, the Reverend Peter Morales, provided a summary, a good side, bad side summary of much of what I've addressed more specifically in the previous 10 years. He did it in a letter he sent to our congregations with his reflections on the 10th anniversary. You may have seen it. It's on the UUA website. I'm going to share a portion of it. He began on the same note as our Peace Poll service did last Sunday. For many of us, the sorrow, fear, and anger of that day rests not so far below the surface. My heart goes out to all who continue to carry such a burden. He goes on, though our country continues to heal from this ordeal, the past decade has tested our commitment to peace and unity. In pursuing goals of safety and security, we have seen the erosion of basic civil rights and an alarming increase in bigotry, especially anti-Muslim and anti-immigrant sentiment. We have seen wars that result in senseless destruction. As many of us continue to struggle financially, we have watched our elected officials provide funds for the machinery of war, impeding our ability to progress in education, health care, and other vital needs. We have grieved, and we continue to grieve for the deaths and the serious injuries to our brothers and sisters in the United States military, as well as the countless men, women, and children caught in conflicts not of their own making. We've seen political bullies rewarded. We've seen the peacemakers of our country dismissed as weak and cowardly. Well, experienced minister that he is, Peter knows you don't end a sermon or a letter with lines like that one. And so he does shift gears toward the end by saying, but let us remember that the events of September 11, 2001 failed to destroy us. They did not diminish our compassion for others, did not take from us the ability to love, to heal, or to gather together as a loving faith community. In the aftermath of that tragic day, we have been given the opportunity to demonstrate our deepest religious values. Biting words and hopeful words are these. I think on them. I think about how in the past decade we as a nation have initiated two wars from which we have yet to extricate ourselves and which continue to take their toll. Yes, they were in response to our being attacked. And yes, the people of Iraq are no longer under the thumb of one of the more horrific dictators to prate across the world's stage. Yet his removal came at a terrible price to them and us. Our military presence in Afghanistan did set the stage for Osama bin Laden's demise, but I don't see how the ongoing life of that nation has changed all that markedly since our intervention there, and one day we're going to leave, and the Taliban will stay in one capacity or another. Personally speaking, I shed no tears over the deaths of either Saddam Hussein or Osama bin Laden, but I still have a hard time squaring the equation when it came to the huge price that was paid and the huge tolls of lives and well-being that were extracted in order for those demises to take place. On the home front, I could point to many examples of what Reverend Morales refers to in his words about bigotry. I'll keep it to just one. When Mr. Keith Ellison was elected to the United States Congress from Minnesota, he became that body's only Muslim member, and he took the oath of office with his hand on a copy of the Quran. This led one of his then fellow congressional representatives, a Mr. Virgil Good of Virginia, to say that such an act was, quote, a threat to the values, beliefs, and traditions of the United States of America, and if American citizens don't wake up, there will likely be more Muslims elected, Dear me, not that. This, as I say, came from a member of Congress speaking about another member of Congress. And while such a denunciation of Representative Ellison and his religion were reprehensible, I'm afraid it was striking a chord that went well beyond the sentiments of the person who made it. Well, okay, such looking back does have its value, which is why I've offered what I have to this point. But it's where we go now that warrants the major piece of our attention and our commitment. And in this time, when I use the word we, I mean we in this setting, those of us of a liberal religious persuasion. I say that even as I know we do not all line up behind the same beliefs, religiously or politically. We probably wouldn't be a UU congregation if that were the case. But I got a very helpful guidepost in suggesting a way forward for my colleague, the Reverend Tom Schad, who is the minister of the First Unitarian Church down in Worcester, Massachusetts. Tom weighed in on a conversation took place a couple of months ago on our UU ministers chat line that we have and comes out about every day. We got on the subject of how we were going to speak about this topic once our church years got going again. And Tom set forth two narratives, as he called them, that have emerged and developed over the past 10 years. He called them the dominant narrative and the alternative narrative. The dominant narrative, as he called it, and quoting him now, holds that the events of 9/11/01, quoting him, prove the existence of evil in the world, that there is an escalating conflict between the West and some undetermined portion of Islam, and we're moving toward an apocalyptic catastrophe. There's a whole segment of this culture, he adds, that accepts this narrative as true. Nothing much we say will sway them. Well, then he gets to his main point. But there's a whole section of this culture that suspects this dominant narrative as being exaggerated and manipulative. They certainly see it as being politicized, and the policy consequences have been disastrous. Sometimes, he says, the life of the Spirit calls a nation to a harder and more difficult path than does its dominant narrative. That harder and more difficult path is an alternative narrative that Reverend Schad calls the liberal religious one. I've been quoting him. I'm going to go on a little further, because when someone else says something I want to say at least as well as I can say it, then I'll use his or her words. I also know that some of my colleagues over the years have used my stuff in their pulpits, so turnabout is fair play. And back to my friend Tom again. The liberal religious narrative, which is so rarely heard in the public square, sees 9/11/01 as a retrograde step in what is otherwise a process by which the religions of the world are accommodating themselves to each other, recognizing in each other the same universalizing impulses. We see the future not as a clash of civilizations, not as an Armageddon, not as a final battle for God. We see a future of peace, cooperation, and diversity. We see that future coming into being right now. And one such way is that all across our country, interfaith coalitions, including but not limited to Muslims, Christians, and Jews, are stronger now than they were on September the 10th of 2011. So I would say, in addition to being a gathered community here with a vibrant and congregational life, we are also people of a narrative. And I think Reverend Schad has given voice to the nature of that narrative very well, as did the Dalai Lama, in the words John shared with us earlier. We need not, we do not exactly and precisely agree on how every aspect of that narrative is to be lived out and acted upon and fulfilled. But it is a narrative we can choose to walk within, with each of us contributing our own thoughts and ideas as to how that walk should go and bringing them together so we can be people of that narrative. Again, we see the future not as a clash of civilizations, not as Armageddon, not as a final battle for God. We see a future of peace, cooperation, and diversity. We see that future coming into being right now. Focus on just those last few words. We see that future coming into being right now. For this is our calling, here at the head of another church year, to bring the future we envision into being right now. This is the umbrella objective as I see it, one that overarches our many fine activities and programs and social justice efforts, to bring the future we envision into being right now. We are to live out among ourselves the world we envision, for that is what living by faith is about. And we thereby then bring our narrative to the greater life and lives of the community and world. It may not be the dominant narrative, but unless it is there in the public square, then the dominant narrative will be the only narrative there is. And think about that. Well, I'm going to leave you with this for today. Last Sunday, after we had our service out by our peace pole, I joined with some of the other members of our congregation and persons from our national community for the observance our local interfaith council held down at the Labyrinth off Main Street. That's a very beautiful, very peaceful place in the midst of a very busy and noisy city. And after some introductory words by the council's president, each attendee was invited to walk the Labyrinth, carrying a stone similar to the ones we used here in our ceremony. And as I took part, and as I did my walk, I thought back to the very first time I'd ever walked on a labyrinth like that. It was five summers ago, in the summer of 2006. I was on a visit to one of my sisters and her husband who live in Texas following the UUA General Assembly, held in St. Louis that year. And I arranged my trip so I could stop by a little crossroads town of Crawford, Texas, on my way. I also stopped by a little crossroad town called Archer City, Texas, so I could take in the ambience of the hometown of one of my literary heroes, Larry McMurtry, but I'll save that story for another day. Well, you know, it was 2006. This was during the Bush administration. I wanted to visit the Crawford Peace House that was set up just a few miles away from the president's ranch. I got there an hour or so earlier than the time I'd arranged to meet with the person who was staffing the place, so the building was closed, and I sat on the front porch seeking shelter from the 100-degree heat until my contact person did arrive. While I was waiting, I noticed that there was just same pattern. It's a standard pattern, the same pattern as the one downtown. There was a labyrinth in the yard right next to there. Had a peace pole at its center, similar to our peace pole out here. Maybe some different languages, but same kind of peace pole. I figured, heat and all, I'm going to walk this labyrinth as I wait for my appointment. So I got out there to walk it, taking care, first of all, to cover my head, and then I set out. It was more of a profound experience than I'd anticipated. That labyrinth, the labyrinth is laid out in such a way that just as you feel you're getting to the center, you get routed back to one of the outer circles again. And then you circle back in, getting a little closer to the center, and then you get routed back out again. And eventually, you do get to the middle. And then you sit back out again, working your way in and out until you're back at the beginning. And you can keep repeating that process for as long as you want. And what struck me the most about all that was how, when I felt like I was getting to the peace pole in the middle, this is the one in Texas now, when I felt like I was getting to the peace pole in the middle, I would get swung back out again away from it. That's how elusive the attainment of peace and love and justice can be. And even when we do get there on occasion or feel like we're there, the journey is never really over. It's an ongoing one for as long as we can keep making it. Excuse me. So think then of those objectives of that alternative narrative, those of peace, cooperation, and diversity. Think of them as being at the center of a labyrinth. It's a labyrinth that we are walking together, each with our own thoughts and ideas, but walking together as the bearers of an alternative narrative. And sometimes we may feel like we're closing in on the center, only to get spun out to the edges again. And even when we momentarily get there, the journey still goes on because more demands come along, moving towards our vision and then move back, move towards, move back, but always walking that narrative. And the important thing, of course, is that we keep walking wherever that labyrinth takes us, walking together while being the world we envision. We begin now another year in the life of this wonderful congregation of walking together. and I look forward to walking with you. As most of you know, my time for walking with you has become limited. But the journey we set forth on this year is every bit as important, and I trust every bit as joyful and every bit as eventful as the 23 that have preceded it. So let's be on our way. And let the words of our closing hymn represent the promises we make to each other as our walk goes forward. It's hymn number 1.